Hello, this is Randy Thompson from the North Carolina Reading Service. Welcome to Music Review. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. For the next half hour, I shall be reading articles about music from such sources as the New York Times, the News and Observer, The Week Magazine, Rolling Stone, and Entertainment Weekly. Music Review is underwritten by Bill McClure, tuning pianos in the Raleigh area since 1968. For more information or to schedule a piano tuning appointment, please call 919-779-1755. This program is designed to provide the latest coverage of classical folk, jazz, blues, rock, country, and pop music news. But first, these musical trivia questions. Today's musical trivia questions come to us from the website onthisday.com. Question number one, it was on this very day, back in 1954, that Robert Zimmerman celebrated his bar mitzvah. What is Robert Zimmerman's stage name? Is it A, Little Richard, B, Bob Dylan, C, Mick Jagger, or D, Willie Nelson? Robert Zimmerman's bar mitzvah today, back in 1954. Who is he, anyway? And question number two, John Lennon did what on this very day back in 1969? Was it A, he left the Beatles, B, he started a 10-day bed-in with Yoko Ono in Canada, C, he performed his song Imagine at an army recruiting station in New York City, or D, he tap danced for an hour on Abbey Road in England? John Lennon, 1969, today, what did he do? The answers to these two important trivia questions will be given, as usual, at the end of today's program. Our transitions come to us from that same website, onthisday.com, and today, quote-unquote, is the weekend of May 21st. Well, it was on this very day back in 1813 that German composer Wilhelm Richard Wagner was born. Wagner was especially well known for his operas, including The Flying Dutchman and The Ring of the Nibelung. And it was 18 years ago today, 2003, that the final manuscript of Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, which was annotated by the composer, sold at an auction for $3.47 million. 2003, today. And in country music news, we have this book review published in Entertainment Weekly, May 2021 issue, by Mark Hirsch. Name of the book? Broken Horses, a Memoir by Brandi Carlile. And a grade of A is given to this new release. Brandi Carlile has had an extraordinary past 3 years, thanks in large part to a thrice Grammy-winning career peak album in By the Way, I Forgive You, plus three more albums worth of material she created for Tanya Tucker, the Secret Sisters, and her own country folk supergroup, the Highway Women. Topping it off with a memoir came out of a hunger that's pushed Carlile to keep working. And Broken Horses is a product and examination of that hunger. It's also about empathy, how it took root within her, the ways it's dictated her relationships, its role as the engine driving her songwriting. The same things that make her music so remarkable can be found in her prose. If you're a fan of Carlile, you already love this book. The story itself waves at a number of familiar beats in the journey of an artist of this ilk, the electric thrill of performing for the first time, The friction of being a gay teen at a time when support was hard to find. The hardscrabble years of hustling to be heard in front of an audience. The successes tempered by complications like prescription drug addiction and romantic self-sabotage. Carlyle is reluctant to simply recount one milestone after another, instead offering through lines that generate connections like a recurring theme about her litmus test for anyone entering her orbit. Even the book's structure is sneakily sharp, with each chapter followed by lyrics to relevant songs, usually but not always hers, in another context that could be dismissed as filler. Here, they are crucial to the story, providing reflection and putting a microscope on Carlyle's songwriting process. The words in Sugar Tooth follow recollections of how a friend's death by suicide affected those who loved him, revealing one glimpse among many of how her life begets her art. Carlyle writes in a voice that's earthy, frank, and endearingly dorky and open-hearted. See her letter asking Eddie Vedder to contribute to a benefit album she oversaw. She's generous with her faults and generous to them, admitting that she can be a narcissistic, insufferable a-hole, and with a way of finding the kindest people to let down, while also extending forgiveness to herself. As the singer writes in her book before she first got signed, she agreed to put her B-sides on the demo that blame her self-titled debut album so that her A material could be recorded properly later. Carlyle since learned not to save the good stuff for later. Besides, she's always found more of it around the corner. Vivaldi's Four Seasons, Spring, introduces our classical music news. It's entitled One Thing to Listen For in Vivaldi's Four Seasons. This is published in musicwithvision.medici.tv, written by Alexandra Haywood, May 17, 2019. Have you ever been so bowled over by the beauty of a piece of music that you're not even sure where to start? Us too. In this new series, we'll be underscoring a single element of a beloved piece that you can use as a port of entry. Up next, the small creatures that inhabit Vivaldi's Spring, some of which are more realistically depicted than others. With its vivid depiction of Mother Nature, Vivaldi's Four Seasons need little introduction. The set of four concertos, one for each season, constitute a veritable ode to nature. And Vivaldi's electric musical depiction of a sudden spring thunderstorm, or the almost oppressive repetition that he uses to evoke the heat of high summer, are firmly entrenched in the pop culture canon. But Vivaldi's attention to detail in this piece runs deep. His musical representations of Mother Nature cohabitate with passages portraying creatures big and small, from the very human sound of chattering teeth to the very Disney princess experience of having a flock of singing birds circle merrily above one's head, the four seasons absolutely brimming with life. But first, if you're wondering how can we even pretend to have so much detail about what Vivaldi was depicting, it's because we have more than just the music to go on. Each of the four concertos is accompanied by a sonnet describing the atmosphere of the season. More than just general inspiration, fragments of the sonnet are interwoven directly into the score, giving us concrete insight into how Vivaldi imagined his music brought to life the poem's vivid imagery. Scholars are unsure of whether the music or the poetry came first, or even who penned the four sonnets. Some believe it may have been Vivaldi himself, given how neatly the three-part structure of each sonnet lines up with the traditional three-movement form of the concerto. The great care he took to align specific musical moments and voices with poetic phrases might suggest that as well. Whoever the author may have been, it's clear that the Four Seasons follows a specific narrative, making it one of the earliest examples of what we call program music, a genre that wouldn't hit its stride for another two centuries. Now, let's get into some of the detail and look at two of the animals Vivaldi gives voices to. While it's the thunderstorm that most people remember about the first movement of Spring, it's actually more of an obstacle than a protagonist in the sonnet. Birds are given pride of place as they celebrate the season's arrival, get interrupted by the storm, and then pick their festive rejoicing back up again. We don't have to wait long for Vivaldi's first musical depiction of the flock, less than 2 minutes in. They arrive in a musical flurry of trills, rapid bits of melody, and chirp-like repeated notes chiming in from across the ensemble in vivid surround sound. Sounds almost like we're under a canopy of trees with birds flitting about above our heads, right? A moment fit for Snow White. And then we get to the second movement and the infamous barking dogs. According to the sonnet, this section of the concerto is meant to depict a shepherd napping in an idyllic meadow, his faithful dog at his side. The question of how we take on this role has plagued violinists around the world. So next time you listen to the Four Seasons, pay attention to the menagerie of creatures living in Vivaldi's musical world. You've met the birds of spring and the shepherd's dog, but there are more to come. Can you make out the buzzing gnats or the sweet song of the turtle dove? Or just focus on the technical prowess and subtle sensitivity it takes to perform all of these roles. Thelonious Monk performing Round Midnight introduces our jazz music news. It's an article entitled, Digging Up Thelonious Monk's Southern Roots. It's written by John B. Wen, All Things Considered NPR, on the 10th of October, 2007. The jazz composer and pianist Thelonious Monk is remembered mainly for his time in New York, where he developed a unique, eccentric musical genius and a stage presence to match. But he was not a native New Yorker. Monk was born in the small town of Rocky Mount, North Carolina. Some scholars and fellow musicians say Monk's southern roots had an overlooked but important influence on the man and his music. According to Sam Stephenson, author of an Oxford American article about Monk's Carolina roots, Rocky Mount was a thriving city in 1917 when Monk was born. An intense tobacco culture flourished, and the rail yard was one of the largest in the entire South. Stephenson speculates those railways may have inspired Monk's composition, Little Rudy Tootie, which features explicit train whistle sounds. There would be train whistles all throughout this neighborhood, all day long and all night long. There aren't any train whistles in New York City. Alan Gerganis, a writer from Rocky Mount, says he hears the legacy of Monk's birthplace in his playing. The combination of that industrial sound overlay in a sense of strangled melody, which is what you feel in him sometimes, this flirtation with the melodic that's then sort of suppressed by these big chords and percussive overlay. I can't help hear Rocky Mount when I hear the music. According to Stephenson, Monk returned to North Carolina only a handful of times, and only once for an extended engagement, a 10-day stint at the Raleigh's Frog and Nightgown Club in 1970. Still, he was proud of his Southern roots. "Here's what Monk used to always tell me," says Paul Jeffrey, a saxophonist who worked with Monk for 6 years. "You know," he said, "I'm a Tar Heel. I think I was proud of being from North Carolina." When you hear his name, you can expect to hear some of the most original and challenging music of the 20th century. Whether it's his dissonant chords or his uncanny sense of space and syncopation, pianist and composer Thelonious Monk's sound is easily recognizable. He left behind a legacy that has had a lasting influence on modern music and fellow musicians. It took years for the jazz world to understand Monk's contribution to the genre, but now his tunes rank among the most played jazz compositions. His classic ballad, Round Midnight, which is playing in the background now, is one of the most familiar themes in all of jazz, with numerous tributes and awards for his work, as well as legions of faithful fans. Monk has earned a unique place in the pantheon of American music. And in music research and technology, we have this article entitled Sisters with Transistors, Inside the Fascinating Film About Electronic Music's Forgotten Pioneers. They turned drawings into symphonies and made black boxes sing. Why were they never given their due? The maker of a new film, full of revealing archive footage, aims to put this right. This is written by Jude Rogers, The Guardian, 23 April, 2021. Wearing a black cocktail dress and a foil bright silver headscarf, a woman stands in the corner of a drawing room performing The Swan by Saint-Saëns, while a group of men look on. Although the scene has a sedate Edwardian air to it, this is actually 1976. The woman whirls her red nails around a mysterious black box, making it sigh and lament, whisper and sing. This is Clara Rockmore, the first virtuoso of the theremin, and her audience, all there to learn, includes Robert Moog, inventor of the synthesizer. A year later, age 66, Rockmore would release her first album, recorded by Moog, 35 years after she made her concert debut on the instrument at New York City Hall, where she arranged spirituals for a black male sextet with composer Hal Johnson. Rockmore also toured widely with the bass baritone Paul Robeson in the 1940s and turned down a request to perform on the spooky soundtrack for Alfred Hitchcock's 1945 thriller Spellbound, as she wanted her instrument to be valued, not treated like a novelty. Rockmore is one of 10 electronic music pioneers featured in Sisters with Transistors, Lisa Rovner's debut documentary, released this weekend. Aiming to connect these women's disparate, noisy stories, the film teams with spliced together archive, footage that recalls the mashup style of Adam Curtis's Nuclear Tests, and beauty competitions swirl around the many revealing clips of the musicians. Because of the nature of the instruments, electronic music making an often isolated pursuit. Nevertheless, one artist featured in Sisters with Transistors, Lori Spiegel, tells me how struck she was by the fact that the women in the film barely knew of each other. How different would things have been if we had? That said, she never thought explicitly about being a female musician. "It wasn't about me, it was about the tech, the freedoms it gave me, and the musical vistas it opened up for me to explore. Technology," says Spiegel, "can be a liberator. It blows up power structures. The younger women who populate the film give weight to this statement. Towards the end of the film, they talk of the psychological thrill that happens when you can see yourself in the people who are being celebrated. As she speaks, you hear other women tuning up the volume, powering up for the future." And in rock and pop music news, we have this article entitled, Q&A, Gwen Stefani, the voice coach and no doubt frontwoman's new single and music video, Let Me Reintroduce Myself, is a celebration of all things Gwen. This is written by Brennan Carley and published in Entertainment Weekly, February 2021 issue. What was your headspace going into making new music? Well, I hadn't put a record out in years. I also was feeling like, does anyone really want to hear new music from me? But I wanted to go back and make something that was joyful and back to my roots where it all started, pre-pandemic. I've been in the studio with Luke Nicoli, and he's the one that said, you should work with my friend Ross Golan, who turned out to be someone who really gets my sarcasm. With Luke, we taught each other a lot, especially when it came to ska and reggae, because I kept saying, dude, no, listen to Sublime. It has to have scratching in it. It has to be 90s. Let Me Reintroduce Myself addresses people thinking of you as a relic. Is that how you feel? Well, I feel like I've had to make excuses for why I wanted to make new music. I felt like people were going to judge me and be like, well, you're like super old. Why would you want to even do that? This is just how my brain works. Ross's reaction was, for us to incorporate, a way of saying, well, I haven't really gone anywhere, if you really think about it. I'm still doing the same thing. I still wear the same kind of stuff that I've always worn. It's just an evolution. So how did you go about concepting the new music video? Well, my fiancé, Blake Shelton, had this epiphany. I really think you should dress up in all the looks that you've ever done. This was before we even knew this was going to be a single. When I told the label, they were like, yeah, let's do this. It was so bizarre, going and dressing up as Don't Speak, and Just a Girl, and Hollaback Girl, and the Blue-Haired Girl, and all these versions of myself. It just makes me feel so proud. I look back at those looks, and I think, what was I thinking? I wasn't thinking. I was doing whatever. These ideas just come to me from above. Basically, the idea is that I'm just hanging out with the different versions of myself. But I'm still me. Here's the 2020 vision, girl. It's so funny because that lyric, 2020-2020-20 vision, that's 100, but I'm not that good at long division. When we were writing it, we were like, S, this is never going to come out in 2020. Should we put 2021? And she laughs. Gwen Stefani. So, how did you do on today's musical trivia questions? Well, the answer to our first question, Robert Zimmerman's bar mitzvah today, back in 1954. Who is he, anyway? Is it A, Little Richard, B, Bob Dylan, C, Mick Jagger, or D, Willie Nelson? Correct answer. Answer B, Bob Dylan. As noted in Haaretz.com, in May 1954, Robert Allen Zimmerman celebrated his bar mitzvah in Hibbing, Minnesota, a small town of about 16,000 residents. Zimmerman's parents were prominent in the Jewish community, and the party they'd held in their son's honor was a major social event, even without any of the guests being able to know that the bar mitzvah boy, whose Hebrew name was Shabtai Zeisel, would grow up to be Bob Dylan. Zimmerman changed his name to Dylan when he began performing in Minneapolis in about 1959. His father and mother were the American-born children of Jews who had immigrated soon after the turn of the century from the Ukraine and Lithuania. Dylan's Jewish tutor was a traveling rabbi who gave Dylan his classes upstairs in a rock and roll cafe. It's reported that the 12-year-old Dylan would, quote-unquote, come down and boogie after his classes. Times they were a-changin'. And the answer to our second question, what newsworthy event did John Lennon do on this very day back in 1969? Was it A, he quit the Beatles? Was it B, he started a 10-day bed-in with Yoko Ono in Canada? Was it C, he performed his song Imagine at an Army recruiting station in New York City? Or was it D, he tap danced for an hour on Abbey Road in England? Correct answer. Answer B, he began a 10-day bed-in with Yoko. As noted in InsideHook.com, the couple staged the bed-in at Queen Elizabeth Hotel in Montreal. They had originally planned for New York, but Lennon was not allowed into the U.S. because of a cannabis conviction. "We're going to stay in bed for many days instead of having a private honeymoon," Lennon said at the time, according to CBS News. "It's a private protest for the violence that's going on in the world," added Yono. "Instead of making war, let's stay in bed." The couple used the media attention as an element in the bed-in, turning the media's craving for stories into a way to speak about peace and discuss how the real work starts at home, within personal relationships. And so, to close out today's program, as John Lennon indicated, imagine.
Imagine all the people living life in peace. You may say I'm a dreamer, but I'm not the only one. I hope someday you'll join us, and the world will live as one.
Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of Music Review. Be sure to tune in at the same time next week. This program's also available as a podcast after the broadcast in our website, ncreadingservice.org. As we leave you now, remember these words. Kindness is a language which blind people see and deaf people hear. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. If you have a suggestion for music to feature on this program, please leave a message for me at 919-832-5138. I'm Randy Thompson, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Music Review is underwritten by Bill McClure, tuning pianos in the Raleigh area since 1968. For more information or to schedule a piano tuning, please call 919-779-1755. So long, until next time.
Imagine no possessions.
Try.
I wonder if you can. No need for greed or hunger.